recording is set up. Well, just checking the picture, it should be, it's very dim, but I think it will be, just leave it there. If you, if the discussion starts here, then you just turn it around, so it comes to the audience. And maybe the, you have also a helper, which I think, actually I don't know who's your helper, maybe. And I hope he or she will show up soon, so.
Oh, now it's recording.
Yeah, it's recording. Okay. Just let it run. So. There's enough. Yeah, there's enough space on the hard disk, so it's no problem.
They have a standalone recorder, so they don't need a complete computer.
I don't know this.
Thank you.
Yes, definitely.
Or do you give it a couple of more minutes? Okay, yeah, let's start. Okay, so, myself, I'm a female, a whatever person, and I'm going to introduce you to Diego Sarabia, who's from the University of Salta in physics and engineering. And he can say more about himself because he's a bit mad in his long, long CV. So, could you memorize all this? So, and the second speaker is Mari McCarthy, who is not here yet. But he's at 12, right? Yes. Well, he'll come when it starts, but I will introduce him. So, who is Mari McCarthy?
Okay. I will introduce myself when I was just will be speaking. I will tell something that is related to me with this talk. My name is Diego Sarabia.
Do you have a presentation?
No.
Okay, so we don't need to figure out what
power.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. My biggest concern is that the audio recording is working, so because it would really be a pity if all three.
So is it really working then?
Yeah, it's really working. I tried it out.
Okay, that's my email address. You can reach me there. All what I will say is here in this book. This book is in Spanish, but they have a translation in the net as a PDF. You can reach, if you put Voces Libres de los Campos Digitales in Google, you will reach a page. In that page you can download. Right here. Ok, Okay, the translation is not very good. They have a lot of mistakes. But if you have some doubt or something, you can write me and correct this. Okay. All of you know about what is free software? Is there anyone that you know nothing about free software? Do you know what is it? Free software? Yes? So we began to talk about free software in America Latina, Latin America. Perhaps we will begin with an organization that is called IFATIA. Because this organization was very important in the beginning of free software movement in South America. You can find page patia.info or I think .net now. IFATIA was a loose group of people that began around 2001. The first meeting was held in Buenos Aires with people from Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina. And then it spanned all over South America. We have people in Italy, also here in England, in India, in China, everywhere. So it was a very influential organization in the beginnings of free software movement in Latin America especially, but in other places also. IFATIA basically wrote two manifestos. First one around 2001, and its manifest established the knowledge revolution as a parallel to the industrial revolution. And we say that the contradiction that the industrial revolution has between private means of production, owned means of production, with public means of production, is the same contradiction that we have in knowledge societies between free knowledge and private knowledge. There are differences between private means of production and free knowledge, but this is, we think, the real contradiction between the similarities between industrial revolution and the knowledge revolution. So we think we are in a moment in the history similar to the industrial revolution. That was the first movement, the first manifest, that is a kind of materialistic view of the process that we are involved with free software and free knowledge. IFATIA focused on free knowledge and free software as a part of a wider movement of free knowledge. The second manifest of IFATIA is more a kind of idealism. It tries to establish a relationship between human rights and knowledge rights. So if you read second manifest, you can find both of them in IFATIA Info. First manifest, I think, is in 7, 8 languages. Second one is in Spanish and English. Okay, the second manifest is about human rights and try to, beginning with human rights, demonstrate that free knowledge basically proceeds from human rights. So we think that people have the right to be free with the knowledge. You know, there is the three basic human rights involved is the right to free culture, the right to education, the right to free communication. This could be in contradiction with 27 articles of Human Rights Declaration that every person has the right to moral and material interest protection regarding scientific, literary, or artistic production on which they have any authorship. So the Human Rights Declaration also speaks about authorship, but they don't speak about property. They speak of rights. There are different rights involved in property than general authorship. So there is a lot of place here to discuss this stuff. This is what the second manifest is about. I think there are interest pieces to study. That were the theoretical framework that we developed in IPATI. But also we have a very activist involvement with governments of the region. The first government that go to free software was Brazil government. We meet around when was Lula administration beginning. We meet with Lula technological advisor, and some of us meet with Lula directly to speak to him about free software. And in fact, one of the members of the party in that time, Sergio Amadeo, was designated as head of the administration technological infrastructure. He has the rank of Secretary of State, so he was a very important appointment. And he could begin in the Lula administration free software involvement. Brazil has a very special case because they previously have a policy of intervention of market. So they have a powerful computer industry before free software. And they have very strong union movement, and they have very strong involved technical people, and all that people is involved with free software. In fact, the beginnings of free software movement in Brazil took the Rio Grande do Sul. Rio Grande do Sul was a state in Brazil that was under Partido de los Trabajadores administration long before Lula government. All that people belong to PATI. So, through the unions, and because of Partido de los Trabajadores of Lula, it's an agreement between a lot of workers' unions in Brazil, they have an excellent platform to go into the government. And they do that. To this guy and other people in different ministries, they go putting more and more free software in Brazilian government. Lula government was an alliance of several parties. And different parties have different ministries. So the ministers with Lula party have picked, they do a lot of advance. And another place, they do not. So you can find in Brazil government different level of advances in free software development. But from 2004, they are doing a really good job in several places. They are a wide movement. In Brazil, they have a congress that is named International Forum from Free Software. You can find, this is very big, probably one of the biggest shows of free software in the world. Now we have the 10th version, so you can see the maturity of the free software movement in Brazil. So looking, they have 10 version here to here. Now, this is held in Porto Alegre, Rio Grande do Sul, when the free software movement began. In Brazil, the software community is organized around something called PSA, Projeto software libre. They have a wide overall presence in the software libre, but they have in every region of the country this kind of project. For example, Proyecto Software Libre RS, Rio Grande do Sul. They have also PSL Women, they have PSL everything. Everyone that wants to do a movement within free software community crisis gets PCL and put everything they want. And this a very important movement, and they gather every year in Porto Alegre. Okay, that's Brazil. The second country.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
When you speak about the movement, which of movement in Brazil, you speak about the grassroots movement or something that is always decentralized and in the government?
They are mixed because the same people is in the same place. PSL are not organized. It's a network or loose connection groups around it. In every state, they meet perhaps once a week, once a month. They use electronic list. They have a web page. You can find it through PSL. It's a multiple connection. Loose network of people. But these people is involved in government. And when Sergio Manuel goes to the government, they put a lot of people in several places. So they have a lot of power. I don't know if you remember, but several years ago, Lula has a big problem with corruption. And they need to put out a minister. This minister was the head of Sergio Madero, the chief. So when this minister left out, Sergio Madero also left out. They lose a lot of power, but they have a lot of people involved in a lot of ministers around the country, so they continue to work very fast, and a lot of people involved in the free software development in Brazil. That's what you asked. Okay. Now Venezuela. In Venezuela, one of the main party was designed as Planista. He was Felipe Pérez Martí. Felipe Pérez Martí is an economist, has a very good article write about altruism and free software. You can find this and another document here. A lot of documents, one of them, this guy worked in games theory. Perhaps you see the movie, I don't know in English what is the name of the movie, but
Beautiful Mind.
He worked with that guy in the place with that guy worked. Felipe Pérez Martí. This guy promoted and he manages to write a decree that was signed by Chavez. But Chavez said that all administration might migrate to this order. It's an order without any kind of discussion. He said that all administration must migrate completely to free software. So the three promoted by Felipe Pérez Martí. One can understand the situation because the Venezuela lives around the petroleum. They have a state company called Cerveza. Basically, all the governments move with money from Cerveza. When Chavez was took out of the government, they managed to return, but then the Bebesa officials began a plot against Charles. This plot was supported by CIA.
You mean this is like a petroleum one, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a petroleum, a big petroleum company. In fact, all the officials of Cerveza was tried, they abandoned the company, they put all the servers under control by the United States because Cerveza had technological informatic infrastructure as a privatized separate company that is owned by people from CIA. So all the company that is completely automatized was controlled from outside the country. And they had Venezuela 1 or 2 months without petroleum, without gas, without anything. It was very difficult to overcome blood. Basically, they changed all the management of PDVSA at that time. And they took control of technological infrastructure with new people. It was a huge battle. I think this is the first example of electronic war in the world. You can find a movie, it's very hard to find, but perhaps you can find it in B2B networks. It's called La Recuperación del Cerebro de PDVSA. To get back PDVSA electronic brain. This is a movie.
A documentary about how Samsung workers did a study rather than the whole army training and tried to start with the foreign company. But the documentary is how it happened.
Yes.
Yeah,
really good. Yes,
really good.
It's a very good.
And there are people from the company that did the strike in the strike, and other people that they, their family wouldn't talk to them, and the kids could like almost in university.
Yes. You see that?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yes. Very difficult to find.
Maybe we should change.
Forever is fine. Very interesting document.
Is it still there? Is it still not?
Oh,
that's
that one.
Okay, very good, yes.
So there is a huge movement to recuperate PDVSA. I think they do not control completely today the technological infrastructure.
They are working hard to do that.
I was in Venezuela 1 year working for PDVSA in the free software project they have. They want to change all its infrastructure to free software. They think that they will need around 10 years to do that. Very complex company. We have every kind of technological infrastructure you can think about, they have. Technological department has around 6,000 engineers working there. So it's a huge lot. The problem that they have is that a lot of trained people is against Chavez, so Chavez is supported by poor people, so they don't have a lot of technical skilled people that agree with them. So they have a lot of problems. They create new universities. They don't like to fight against old universities. They leave, they do what they want, but they are creating new universities around this, but the technological level of this new university is very low. They are beginning, so it's a huge movement to transform all society in PDVSA, in Venezuela and in PDVSA in particular. And they have a lot of resistance from free software movement
the peace of our movement is all the society divided between people that Chavez and people that do not support Chavez. And you have this kind of discussion every place and everywhere in Venezuela. They have a national organization that is called SOLDO. It is called SOLDO.
Now I am directly board of this organization.
So we have embraced PSL and SOLDO. SOLDO is like a traditional ONG for. Brazil is the only place that I know that they have this kind of network organization. Because I think it's bigger. They have this kind of thing. The PCL goes not only in peace, but all those social forum, World Social Forum. I don't know if you heard about the World Social Forum. They meet together in that place. Okay. So it's more traditional. It's not an organization like that kind of organization. In Solve, there are people that support Chavez and people that do not support Chavez. So they are continuing fighting about that kind of issue. A lot of technical people in free software movement do not like Chavez. They have the same problem as the technical. Okay. You know, first Brazil, second Venezuela. We can talk now about Equator. Equator, Ecuador, I don't know how it's in English. Ecuador changed president around 2 years, I think. One of the six advisors of Correa, Rafael Correa, excuse me. Part of the free software movement in Ecuador. Part of the organization is called ASLE. It's like Solve in Venezuela. ASLE is a normal ONG organization. The technological advisor, Rafael Correa, belongs to ASLE. And he managed to convince him to meet with Rachel Stallman and a lot of stuff like that. You can find on YouTube a video about Rafael Correa saying they must use free software. I think probably this is the most well organized free software government involved in Latin America. They are doing very well. Without a lot of coffee, they are advancing very well. It's ASNE, linked with Rafael Correa, not because all ASNE members support them, but they agree what he's doing with his office. Equator is, as Brazil, as Venezuela, is part of the country in South America that plays a different forms of made policy. So we have a very strong relationship, as you can see, between this kind of politics and free software. Every country that changed government to the left also adopts free software. The only exception that I know about that is Bolivia. I don't know why, but I don't see today a strong involvement Bolivia will do so, but perhaps they have a lot of other problems. There are people that in the government that is trying to do that, but they don't succeed yet. There are a lot of experience. They have a national organization like ASNE Observer. They are trying to do one, but they cannot do it yet. Perhaps they don't have maturity to do that, to preserve a movement in Bolivia. The next country we can talk about is Paraguay. Paraguay changed government around 1 year, I think, for now. And the people that is running technological, environment infrastructure is also involved in the free software movement here at the beginning. In fact, they were in Argentina around 1 or 2 months ago discussing this plan with people from Argentina, this whole community, because power is very small, so they don't have a big community there, so we are helping them to do this. So, the other country that is in this political line is Cuba. Cuba, was with Cultura Minister around 2 years, and with the Central Committee of Communist Party of Cuba, responsible for Cultura, I was talking with them. There is a medium community working in Cuba, developing around medical infrastructure. They have in CubaMed, that is an organization related to medicine, a relatively big community of this over development. So they have technical expertise to do that, and they are working on that line. They have no current to do the migration because they don't have legal right to use Microsoft or something like that because the United States are blocking them. So everything that they use is illegal, so they don't care nothing about legality, copyright, and things like that. But they are trying to change because of security. In fact, in Cuba, there are a project called NOVA, these guys are working together with us. I don't tell you, but several years ago, they developed a project called IFUPO. In Argentina, we will talk about Argentina in a minute. And we are working together. It's a different project, but we are constantly interchanging things. All distribution now is working around in 2. They are very similar. Cubans want NOVA to be completely independent, so they work, we share things, but we have independent projects. Because NOVA is used by the Cuba Army, so we have a lot of secrecy about that. They have set up a Cuba university in an old Soviet abandoned base, military base, and then they have a university completely devoted to technology, and one of the faculties completely devoted to free software. So they have a lot of people learning free software. They have very big problem with internet because they are blocked. They have a lot of fiber going around the island that they cannot connect. The only internet connection that Cuba have is via satellite to Canada. So it's very slow. It's very slow, so it's very difficult to work with Cuban people. Now, Venezuela is trying to put a special channel, this fiber channel, in the island. I don't know when this will happen. Probably in that time to know more about what's happened there.
Which university was
the one that was? I don't remember the name now, but I could send you by mail.
I
will send you by mail.
Okay.
Yes, I don't remember now the name of the university. It's very an old army Soviet base. Yeah. Okay. That is Cuba. So these are all the countries that are aligned against the United States. All have this own involvement in one of another one. In Argentina, we never have this kind of government, but we have some relationships with several governments. Nothing really hard. They are very influenced by Microsoft and this kind of organization. So they want to trust them and they want to develop a national software industry based on this company.
So they think that they will have economical progress
with the large infrastructure of
people working cheap to develop software.
They think they believe that. So they are trying to go to that model of economic development of software. With a lot of cheap workers developing software. So because we have lower wage, we can develop software, private software for the world. The government thinks that this is the way to do it. So we cannot manage to convince our government.
But in fact, we have in Argentina one organization, a community that is solar. It's like ASLE, like Solve. It's a free software organization. It's an NGO. Around 300 people as members of this organization.
We have also in Argentina a lot of dispersed Linux user groups.
We have a continued tension between Loop and Solar because Solar is more qualified.
Loop don't like to be bolder with politics. General and Solar is involved in the project.
So we have different kinds of relations with Loop. In Argentina we have several development projects.
I think the oldest one could be Ututo. Ututo was one of the first live systems in the world around 2000, I think.
I developed this in the university because I work in a solar energy institute in Salta University, and we have people coming to learn from all over the place in Latin America, and we have
solar energy system simulators developed in free software,
and in that time it was very hard to install a new Linux distribution. So we made this live system with all the simulator we have, so the people could use easily. This distribution, 1 or 2 years after the creation, was used by
Buenos Aires government in the school system. It was used as a router and put in all the schools.
So Tuto was put in the network Buenos Aires school. It's around 2002, I think.
1 or 2 years after that,
Tuto, I passed the project to Daniel Oliveira, out his master of Tuto, and in that time we arranged to
develop a complete free distribution. So Tuto was the first distribution in the world recognized by Starmat completely free. Now there are several more, but in that time it was the first one. There is another completely free distribution in Ututo
in Argentina called Music. Music, Ututo was based first in a mix of SUSE and Debian. The router was completely doing independently from all distribution, from scratch.
And the actual version used some stuff from Gentoo.
It is independent, but they use some stuff from Gentoo. Music is based on Debian, it's also completely free, and the music is developed for music labels. So it's a very successful distribution between people with music interest. A very good distribution. There are some different projects in Argentina. One of these is ALBA. This is a project for developing software in education. They have a system to do administration of a school.
This is one of the most known Argentina project.
So, this is a fast traveling around different countries, government involvement, community movements, and the
interrelation between them. We have a strong interrelation between movements and governments. We have several fights in Latin America because not all people agree with things. For example, in Argentina we have this division. We have also in Latin America something called Free Software Latin America, perhaps you know it. I and another people oppose that organization because we think it's not a democratic one. We want to develop an association between Solar, ASME, PSL, Volver, etc. This never happened today, but perhaps in the future. And we have very different visions between this kind of vertical organization that depends on the star and not the entity, and this kind of organization that are elected or depends on loose network elections of people like this. So if you want to understand the fights we have in South America about this software, more or less you could do it look at this kind of organization and this kind of organization. There are people that work for two of them, but they don't see any problem. But
there are people that do not agree with one form of organization for another.
So we have this kind of discussion.
Yeah. Other kind of discussion we have is between, for example, open source or free software. Do you perhaps you already know about this kind of discussion? In South America, almost all people speak about free software. So we have a little people that wants to be part of this movement, but the majority of South America speaks about software libre. Perhaps Spanish helped because we don't have the problem that you have confusion free as something cheaper, that they don't have cost with freedom. South America, gratis is not the same as libre. Different words. So we don't have the confusion English people could have about the meaning of free software. So software libre the term software libre has very important advantage in Spanish country. A lot of people use it because of that. So, I think that's it.
Now,
yes, it's a very complex question. We have a lot of guide of migration. Every organization that wants to migrate develop one. In the beginnings, around 2000, I was in charge of the university office for technological cooperation, and we began a process of migration. We managed to migrate around 20 or 30% of the university infrastructure, including every machine in the university. And this was a very hard process. I was involved also in PDVSA with this kind of process. They are planning a 10-year horizon for doing the migration. They have sensitization. I was
1 year traveling around Venezuela, giving speeches to all the organizations about this topic. They have the occasion. That is a complete plan for the payment to all technical infrastructure.
There's many people, many persons, yeah. Engineers.
And they have also plans for all this stuff around. PDVSA owns 12,000 gas stations in the United States, for example. So we have a lot of people to co-educate in this zone and a lot of machines to change. It's a very difficult process. These are the two key components of the plan. Also, they have the plans to develop projects. To change the software because they have software to do the stuff they do for extracting petroleum. A lot of software to extraction. They have huge projects around, I think that we have around 2,000 different projects. Some of them of more than $100 million for changing all that software. A lot of people will be involved. So migration is a very difficult process. Organization and the country. There are a lot of stuff. Ututo, for example, have several repositories for different processes. We have different executables for Pentium, 486, 586, because we have it governed throughout Latin America, very old machines. So we have to compile it for different kind of processor. Because of that, you must use it in a very low machine, very low machine, for example. That's part of this kind of stuff. You can develop the technical structure to do the migration. They have to recompile OpenOffice, for example, to put all the stuff they need. So when you are trying to migrate big organization, you need to visualize this process like a very complex engineering project, a very complex one with a lot of people involved. We began the plan with 4 people to plan after, this is the strategic planning. We go with 30 people in the tactical planning, and when they leave Venezuela, they have around 200 people involved in the planning process. No, it's a very, very complex process. You don't know how much they have right now.
Can I ask you about the, is it a, sort of like an ideological thing between this region with the SRA, because of Latin America? Is it ideological? What is it organizational? Is it membership? Like, what's the difference? Why are they debating? Are they debating the open source free? So state or are debating politics, like in the actual implementation of migration or actual politics of government in Latin America? What are they?
First, there are people that work here and there. So the difference between is our organizational issues. Free Software Latin America has a small board of people, I think elected by Stallman, and these people call the people that they want. So they say, hey, you want to go to Free Software LA? Okay. Agree, you go. This kind of organization are ONG with legal statute, and all the boards are elected by the association. So there are different kinds of organizations. This go from up down, and this go from down to up. That's the difference between that. I understand the point here. These people think that they want only the people that live compromising with the idea. So they don't like to have people they do not trust the idea. So we have here very few organizations with a lot of people involved, and perhaps a lot of people there do not completely agree with free software idea. They like because they like Firefox, I don't know, and they go and they participate in the discussion and they combine, so they do not agree and they leave. This is a more, you know, vertical organization of pure organization, and we want good ideas. These are the profile of this kind of organization. In general, this kind of organization are broad and open, and they have a lot of stuff. Debating continues. These are the principal differences. But there are people that are involved.
Okay, no, when Peru introduced the paper in 2001, the Microsoft business case had been used. They're quite stamped on, but also when the US ambassador was in. Has there been any more such few attempts to from the Microsoft side?
Oh, in every country, you know. Peru, they have an organization like that, but it's not really strong right now. I don't care about them. This bit will not pass. There is in Latin America also a list, a mail list called Proposition. Proposition in Spanish. That debates about law. I think no country of South America will pass a law about free software.
Venezuela was a charge decree,
a resolution from the president, but not a law. They were discussing a law, but they have a lot of problems in striking a participation in that kind of debate. Some people want something that they call national software. They don't like free software, they want national software. I don't really know what they want, but they speak that way. And we know that Microsoft was supporting them. So they adopt a different kind of strategy depending on where they work. They don't pass a lot. As yet. Yeah. Argentina have rotation, Peru they don't have majority, in Peru also. I don't know a country with a lot. In Brazil, in Rio Grande do Sul, not in federal government. In federal government they have a group of legislators to support free software, but I think they don't have majority to pass a law. But in Rio Grande do Sul, several years before, when PT was in power, Rio Grande do Sul before Lula government, they have a state law. This law says that government must prefer free software. They don't order to use it, but they say the government must prefer. But the opposition in Rio Grande do Sul, the PT, the Partido de los Trabajadores, the opposition now is running Rio Grande do Sul. They go to the court, to the, I don't know the level of the court, the regional court. And they say that this is this state law was unconstitutional because they say that the law gives preference to some kind of software. So this state law was derogated or something like that by the court, the Supreme Court of the state, under this razón. Because the law speaks about one kind of software. So every time that some people want to develop a law saying that, I want them to not put free software as a kind of software. What I think law must have is something that is said. In the state, the software that the state uses must have several properties. One of the properties that include inspect the software, modify the software, blah, blah, blah. I see, I think that when you develop a law, you will be very careful not to present free software as a kind of different software.
You might say, okay, the software that the state used because of that reason, you can put the reason, must be open, blah, 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 whatever you want. This was one of the biggest problems they had
before they go to the federal government.
Another thing that is important when you make laws or resolutions or something like that, at least in Venezuela, is that the order of charge will not say anything about publishing free software that governments produce. So they say, okay, this is free software, but it's nothing that say that I must publish it. It's free, you get it, you can use it, but they will not publish. Because they have a lot of fear about that, and we cannot convince them to change that mentality. So you almost can't find anything about Venezuela free software. All the government that's developing software keeps inside.
Bad report.
Can we take a couple of more questions and then we can answer all of them?
Okay.
Just kind of following up on your question. I mean, Microsoft really back to my understanding, they want to give away free copies of Microsoft and then send them to computing. And so I just wondered how people are selling these free open source software. Particularly, I wonder if it was connected into kind of wide debates about IT.
Venezuela in particular, you can't, they don't publish. If you aren't part of Cerveza staff, you cannot contribute to what they're doing. They are a community project, but the same is never there.
So when it comes to that, so you can have it. If you have a
Debian,
yeah.
Oh, there is a huge Debian community in South America. A lot of people is involved in Debian, yes. I'm not part of them, so I really don't know that, but I think they have a lot of problems because they are not being affected by them. It's a long process to become a member of the Debian.
They have a lot of problems with that.
That's
you have a lot of fight between the food, the baby, and all the standards. It's the wood.
Yeah. The second one was about software and
okay, Microsoft tried to put all to South America something called Alianza for the Education, Educational Alliance. And they tried to sync this agreement between Microsoft and governments about free use of Microsoft software in education schools. They say that they can use free Microsoft product, you will pay $3 per CD or something like that, and try to do that. We have a very strong opposition to that kind of project around all South America. They pay a lot of money. They try to teach teachers in the school to use only Microsoft product. They say, we will learn how to write a letter using software. And you go to the classes and you will see a class about Microsoft Office. It's propaganda, but they present this as education for education. Okay, I really don't know if Venezuela, something Venezuela is trying to do that. Very difficult to have a broad vision of what's happening in Venezuela. There are a lot of different people doing different things. I really don't know if they're trying to do that. I know an European project trying to do that, inspired in Salvador Allende role. I don't know if Venezuela they're trying to do that. I could ask if you want. I could ask them perhaps. Okay.
And the last one for it, that they end and business to decide to go software.
Okay, the political reason to use, why are we trying to combat, to convince our government to use this method? Okay, there are a lot of reasons for that. In fact, we have in the docs in Patia, a document with almost 22 reasons, I think we put there reasons or why government must use this software. Cost is one of them. You asked me, I think, about cost.
Yes.
And Marcelo Branco was a very important people in Brazilian free software movement. Every time he gives a speech about free software, they put the price of every Windows license compared with soy production, because Rio Grande do Sul produce a lot of soy. So they always say, I don't remember the actual number, but they say, we need 2,000 kilos of toneladas of soy to buy, to produce 2 toneladas of soy to buy one Microsoft license. That means 200 people must work 1 year to get one Microsoft license. It was a very good presentation that you would give about the cost. In fact, in Brazil, the government spent more money on Microsoft license and Oracle license and stuff like that than in all scientific development.
The Brazil
budget have more money for licensing than for scientific involvement. All science ministers have less budget than they will need. I don't know if they really pay that money, but if you count all machines using Microsoft Windows and Office, and you multiply by the price you must find, you will have more money than that. In fact, Sergio Amadeu was put under a trial by Microsoft, accused of, I don't know how to say, to do mispresentation of Microsoft. He goes to a jury, because Microsoft accused him of defamation. Yes,
because he said that Microsoft acts
as a drug dealer.
Sergio Madero. Microsoft go back with him
when Richard Stallman gave us a copy of a talk
that Bill Gates gave
in a university in the United States, saying that he don't care about Chinese people pay him or not using Microsoft.
That what they want is that they use it.
And they will try, and he's sure that eventually they could manage to
get all that money.
That is the
normal drug dealer operation.
So you read this positive findings that
Yes, I think in ESL site they must have. Write me and I will find it. Okay. I don't know if it's easy to find because it's 4 years ago.
Yeah.
We have here, so I think it's here, something called Biblio. That is a huge file of bibliographical reference about this software.
Until I think 2005.
So the whole history probably will be listed here. I don't know if the links continue, but we can
insert
that.
What?
Oh, Chiapas. I don't really know anybody Chiapas using free software, but I know people of Chiapas. We meet in World Social Forum with a lot of people around the world, and every people in these social movements agree with free software. That's something that we are trying to do in all that here. And I know that people from Chiapas agree, but I don't know if they really do something with that. Probably they do. I don't have any further information. People really are doing that is very nice.
Yeah, I know it's a bit
supposed to talk about Hello. Hey.
We had a falling out over a wiki. Thanks for thinking about it anyway.
A
few people mentioned it. Adam's got childcare, he was going to come, but he said he
should go on. Okay. Where is this?
It's an MP3 recorder.
Okay. This is actually my major concern, that we record all the stuff. Can you put in the stream there? I mean, I have set up my laptop and the microphone, but it would be better if you have double.
Of course. Well, I'll just put what I'm recording on Indonesia. He's going to record the one next door.
Okay.
I'm not here tomorrow, but I'll record whichever session comes out today. And yeah, I'll pick it up when you need it.
That would be right.
You're welcome to copy them.
If you would have one device for one room.
This is a place I really
want
to go to.
So I don't have to
turn it on.
Just turn it on, start the record, and just let it run.
When you end up with really big file size files, they're quite hard to chop up afterwards.
Yeah, but
have you got an SD? Okay, well this has got an SD card in it.
Mm-hmm.
So what we can do at the end of the day, we can pop the SD card out, put an SD card in, put it into the USB slot, and copy the
file. We can do that afterwards, after the conference.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been trying to very...
It's not much of a concern. My main concern is to record all these things. I'm not 100% sure that this works fine.
It's worth having
a superior microphone, a lot of noise, and maybe if you can move around and take with you, then you can have at least a backup for those sessions.
We can leave this in this one room if you want.
I would really appreciate.
The economy collapse, everybody started going that's what you guys were talking about. It's nice to be able to say it's all just over, and we should wear it under the circumstances. Yeah, so what's your story? Your Greek
returning? Yes, I'm from Athens,
what's your feeling? Realized.
Is it cold now
or anything? What? No, not really. It's about same as here. I can wait. I'll do anything. Never met you before, but you know.
I'm trying to get my myself.
Okay. Well, well, it's like
be really quick.
More minutes and then more people come in because you have the
time.
I kind of planned this to be 1.5 hours, and then I was like, oh shit, earlier when it was hitting, like, it's supposed to be 45 minutes, so I'm going to talk really quickly instead.
Well, what you told me, you are running a certain question. It's up to you to divide
yeah.
the time between two interview and answer the question.
Yeah. That would be fine. We'll figure something out.
Sorry, it's something.
No, no, no. Yeah, I'll probably get into it just a bit in the beginning, but long story short is I kind of run fab labs, fabrication laboratories. Well, just one in Vestmanna, which is a small island off the south coast of Iceland. It's takes about 3 hours to get to by boat. So, then I go around a bit. There's other labs. There's 37 labs worldwide at the moment, and what they're doing is providing people can come on in off the street and start making things, and this could be anything from buildings to circuit boards and the entire spectrum. So I'll probably start. So I think I put a few pictures in there, I'm not sure. We'll see. Your call. Do we wait?
Let's start going on. Okay, so Smari is Smari McCarthy. He mentioned the fabrication lab and the Icelandic Innovation Center.
Yes, that's my employers.
Yes. And he's going to talk about scarcity.
Yes, or the lack thereof.
Yes.
By way of a pre-production, I kind of like to say that my life has been a bit of a duality for the last couple of years. I've been, on the one hand, working on highly technical things, and on the other hand, working on highly political things. You can guess which one represents which. But essentially, it's a very long, complex tale of interconnections through various projects. It just gets more complicated every day. But essentially what it started out as is I kind of got into the entire free software movement about a decade ago and got really interested in how software works and that kind of thing. And the more I learned about it, the more I got involved in this entire freedom debate. And I always like this quote because it kind of explains more or less everything that what I'm working on represents. And of course I had to put this one here because we're in England. I really don't like this kind of thing. But the thing is, the entire battle for freedoms and all that is it's always a long and bloody battle. There's some of them are more famous than others. This is from Chicago, the Haymarket Massacre. And it seems that, when I was working on the entire free software thing, I was completely oblivious to the fact that really the freedoms are not as easily defined as free software people like to think. And, this one is from Iceland. This is the first occasion of two that tear gas was used in Iceland. Occasion was about a month or two ago, just before our government collapsed. So, through this entire thing, I got into realizing that the more technologically advanced we get as a culture, the more our physical freedoms, in the sense of what we can say politically, what we can do within our basic systems, they're all always hinging more and more on the freedoms we have in the digital world. So the question came up, how do we push all of that stuff down into the physical world, all the stuff that we've been doing in cyberspace for a couple of decades and doing pretty well with? Because free software is a very solved problem. We know how to do it. We've got really smart models. Yes, there's still lots of research in that field, but you know, the more we get into the physical realm, the less freedoms we really have. So I got involved in this FabLab thing, which is all about taking the entire concept of manufacturing and pushing it down into the level of where individuals could participate. And it kind of, like that there picture is the sort of kind of just design something, code it, then you know you print it. And I often joke that my work in that field is done when I can download a chicken sandwich off the internet. So, so to explain the picture here, one of the more interesting projects that has happened was in the north of Norway, somebody decided to build GSM phones for sheep, just that hang around their necks and transmit, so you can call up the sheep and get GPS information about them. And there's been all sorts of similar projects. And it all comes back to this little thing. Back in the 50s, I think it's 1954, that the first CNC milling machine was created at MIT, and it was huge, it sucked, and despite the best efforts of everybody, this technology still sucks. We're at the point today where, yes, we have rat wraps, but, you know, has anybody used a rat wrap? Oh, great. You know, wrap wraps are really, really cool because they print stuff and make 3D objects, but they're remarkably hard to get a hold of, and they're very young technology. And even if they stop being young technology, they're still, at the end of the day, fused deposition modeling tools, which means that they're going to be very granular, and you're never going to get you're never going to be able to print out chicken sandwiches with that kind of technology. So there's a lot of work to be done. And this FabLab thing is a dual-pronged approach. On the one hand, it's just pushing forward the technology, trying to get the RapRap to do everything that RapRap should, trying to get the magical Star Trek replicator kind of thing. But on the other hand, we're trying to push the available technology out into the field as soon as possible in order for basically everybody to understand what the implications of this technology is. And you have to ask these questions like what happens if the molecular assembler, the perfect molecular disassembly device, comes into existence tomorrow? How will society react to that? Will people in general be able to handle that kind of transformation? I mean, what happens if some company comes up with a technology and patents it and says, no, we're not going to share the technology with anyone, we're just going to, you know, have a monopoly on making everything for a couple of years. Yeah? And that kind of thought is very scary. So the entire FabLab concept is, to me, it's just making sure that by the time this technology appears, everybody will know exactly how it works. And that's a very important thing. So this is a open source design of a CNC mill that we were playing around with a while ago. And this here is a project we were doing in Afghanistan a couple of months ago, well, in January. I kind of missed the Islamic Revolution because I was doing this. And to explain, these are directional parabolic antennas built out of plywood and chicken wire mesh. It's as cheap and simple as you can possibly make it, and we're spanning 4 kilometer links with chicken wire mesh. It's completely insane. And what we did during the course of 2 weeks was, with 7 people, we kind of just carpeted an entire city with free wireless internet, and for that for about $40,000, including our flights, which were the most expensive part of the food, the hosting, etc. So with that thing, we showed not only are FabLabs actually capable of doing cool things, but they are also capable of doing them far better than the aid agencies, etc., that have been sitting with hundreds of employees years with nearly unlimited budgets. They haven't, to my mind, had any really cool success stories like this. But this entire thing just, you know, the more I got into this entire debate, the more I learned that at the end of the day, it isn't about really cool technologies, about being able to print out stuff. Because, you know, being able to print out chicken sandwiches won't change who we are as people. Like, society has chicken sandwiches, they know what they do for us. So, I kind of got into reading all the old literature, and it turns out that all the really cool ideas that are coming out, they're all 200 years old. We're not inventing anything, we're just implementing it. And, you know, so you have to start asking questions about food. And it came down to the point where I was faced with two underlying assumptions that are basically underlying everything in society. Every single thing in the way societies function nowadays are based on two lies. And I call them lies because I think that they may have been well-intentioned originally, but they are very, they've become such an integral part of how society is defined that they have the same effect. And on the one hand, there's Hobbes' lie, which narrowly, really condensed, is without a strong centralized government, humanity will essentially go into chaos, the bellum omnium contrarianus, war of all against all, and we will all die. I kind of don't really believe that's going to happen, and the fact that we have the free software movement at all, kind of points out that that isn't the case. The other lie is that without a strong centralized government or some sort of method of restricting the access to resources, then people will use them all, finish them, and then we'll all starve to death. So either way we die. And of course, Christian mentioned in his last thing, Gerd Hartmann's Tragedy of the Commons, which is essentially a modernization of that lie. And now, of course, the fact that I'm saying that these are lies kind of needs some sort of justification. So I'm going to cite a few statistics. The first statistic is food, because food is something we all need and that kind of thing. So according to the United States Agricultural Agency, the produce of vegetables worldwide is about 6.2 billion tons, metric tons. And the average consumption of food of a American is 884 kilos of food a year. So if you divide that, you'll see that there's more vegetables than all of humanity needs to sustain themselves. And we haven't even counted meat, fish, dairy products, eggs, that kind of thing. Yes, a lot of the vegetable produce goes into raising animals and stuff, but at the end of the day, food does not appear to be scarce. And what more, about two-thirds of all food that's produced in the world is thrown away every year. That's, if anybody's ever gone dumpster diving, then you'll understand what I mean. It's not just at the production point where the farmers are throwing away stuff, for example, in the United States, where they just get paid more money for producing less stuff. But also in supermarkets where they find one rotten apple and just say, okay, there might be more rotten apples statistically, so let's throw the entire batch out. And it just doesn't really make sense. You can go through similar statistics with building supplies, with concrete, with wood. There are definitely some kind of like Maoni that are becoming endangered and so on, but what it all comes down to is the fact that there's currently about 80 million people who are below the hunger threshold. There are about another 8 million that are in subprime living conditions, like don't have roofs over their heads or whatever. And none of this needs to be the case. And, well, there's basically
the problem is distribution systems, and both Karl Marx and Adam Smith and all these other theorists wrote extensively about how the entire distribution problem was the only remaining problem in their ideal models. So, I often mention veganism, as you say, to Park Dumsterdag as the perfect social phenotype for there being abundance. That is to say, there's so much stuff that we don't even need to work, we can just go out and Dumsterdag for it. So we kind of need to define scarcity, and I ventured on this kind of definition that you may or may not agree with, but the method of this definition is to say, can it be depleted, or let us say, use it sensibly, can it be depleted? And then, alternatively, the concept of rivalry. Does the use of anything preclude the use of others of the same thing, which for free software, for example, or software in general, software is not rival, anybody can copy it. Whereas this chair here, it's quite rival. You know, if I sit and if you can't, ha. And I kind of put up this little, two-dimensional graph where I kind of put in loads of concepts that, you know, some are rival, some are not, some are scarce, some are not. And, there are some things that are inherently scarce. The Eiffel Tower is inherently scarce. There will always be one Eiffel Tower. You cannot copy it. If you copy it, it isn't the Eiffel Tower, it's just copy. You know, that's just because it's defined socially, through its history and its what it is. And the same goes for the 15th century manuscripts. If you make a new one, it isn't 15th century, it's just a replica. Yeah. So, on the other hand, there's a bunch of stuff that isn't scarce. Music isn't really scarce. None of us can ever sit down and listen to all the music that's ever been produced. But on the other hand, you could say that good music is scarce. Okay. So, you know, at the end of the day, it all comes down to this. And when dealing with this kind of thing, I kind of got challenged with how do we fix it? How do we break the assumptions of Malthus's lie, of Hobbes' lie, break all this weird stuff that's going on? And, it's affecting a lot of people. And you might see that these two don't really match up. So human development index and Gini coefficient. Gini coefficient, for those who don't know, is a measure of relative inequality, while the human development index says whether or not you're going to have food on the table. And the story so far is essentially that its scarcity is artificially maintained. We know that there isn't any scarcity. It has been measured. Regarding the agriculture thing again, a paper by Perfecto et al. Showed that you could easily quadruple the world's agricultural output, that's vegetables and beans and so on, by just switching to organic fertilizers. Something that seems so obvious that nobody's ever tried it. Or very few, and they're one of the called perks. So, we're involved in this entire social movement where we want more freedom from oppression, we want more freedom to do whatever we want, and everything in between. And it's kind of like a stack of freedoms, where at the bottom you've got the freedom to exist, the freedom to have physical form, freedom to radiate electromagnetic radiation into the atmosphere or environment. And, the higher up you go, you get into more abstract things for example, the freedom of speech, which is very abstract. It's something that you need to be a very high-level organism to be able to comprehend what it is, let alone have it. So consumerism trashing our planet, economic underpinnings are lying in continuous subservience, and we all want to make this new industry 2.0 where we redesign the industrial revolution to serve the service needs of those who actually need it, as opposed to the companies that have had a really great time for the last 200 to 300 years just using us. And The guy who came up with this term, non-exotic objects, as to say, the exotic objects are things like the Eiffel Tower, that you know, are always scarce. And it came down to a couple of things. I kind of mapped out like nine origin points of what needs to change if we want to change the entire distribution, if we want to level out the distribution of wealth. And the first thing that came to me one night was that the law is essentially a social software project. It's code, legal code, that's running on top of society, and anybody could essentially change it, but no, it, even though it exists in the public domain, let's say the law is freely copyable, etc., it's developed by a committee, and the committee decides what gets to be in there. And it's also self-modifying code. That is to say, every time something changes in the running of the society, some back effect or like rebound effect from the proletarians or the whatever causes the code to change. And the laws take effect. They start running on top of society. We kind of can't really do much if the law turns out to be really bad. So modern democracy, oh, I forgot to translate that one, sorry, to translate, modern democracy, at the top you have a legislative parliament, below it you have political parties, and then way below them you have people at varying degrees, depending on how important they are. And, you know, we kind of have to ask, can we do this better? Well, the internet already has, EDM, production, and knowledge, and I mean, we've already democratized mass media, we've already democratized production, we've democratized knowledge. So when are we going to democratize democracy? Okay. It's a nice idea. It doesn't work, right? Never mind Twitter. So this is what people have been saying, like, direct democracy, it just doesn't work. And people can't keep up with every issue, unless they're parliamentarians, but they're special somehow. I really don't understand this logic, but I'm willing to say okay, you might be right, so let's find some middle way, some middle ground. And when you go to vote, when you're participating in an election, you have two options. You have the option to participate, select yes or no. You have the option to abstain, as in put in black vote or just not show up. And what happens if you add the third option, proxy? Allow somebody else to vote for us. Like, just say, I don't know about this issue. I just don't know what to do. So what happens if I give it to you? I could do it generally. I could say, I'm apolitical, but you're a nice guy. I trust your opinions. We could also do it categorically. I don't know anything about agriculture or health services or whatever. But I kind of trust you, Or you could do it on a per issue basis. Sorry, I'm really busy, can't get myself into this, but I feel this is an important thing and I kind of trust your judgment on this. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about, because when we're electing representatives in a representative government, what we're trusting is not their ability to make the right choice, but their ability, we're just trusting in their judgment. We're trusting that overall, they will most often take the right choice. And of course, what happens is that if anybody's been drawing a picture, it turns out that this is a directed acyclic graph. That is to say, you've got loads of nodes, which are people, and some of them are voting directly, and the other ones are creating edges between themselves, saying, I'm going to trust this guy. And every single form of government we've ever seen on in the history of the planet exists as a possible state in a system. And we also get a load of really new and creepy ones that never would have made sense as political doctrines, but the most easy one is dictatorship. Everybody forwards their vote to one person. Never mind why they would do that. Some people are crazy. The less obvious one is the representative democracy, which, judging by this, turns out to be some sort of highly advanced form of dictatorship. You've got the, sorry about that. You know, because even though people are voting for different parliamentarians, then at the end of the election, when once the votes have been tallied and people get their seats, then you've got essentially a mapping from both voters to votees, or you know, from people who are casting the votes to the people who are going to make the decisions. So this here is the case study of Iceland, a representative democracy with 63 parliamentarians. I mean, is that necessarily better than how about this? It looks a bit mad, doesn't it? It's a kind of ad hocracy. It's you've got people that are voting, you've got people who aren't, you've got people who are forwarding their votes to each other. It seems a bit crazy until you start asking questions about the structure. Now, I made a mistake in this one. You see it? That could never really happen. And, you know, if we were to imagine this as a software system, then once somebody creates a loop, then they would get a warning like, you created a loop! Please destroy the loop. And, you know, of course they will. So, you know, somebody will have to destroy the loop, otherwise all of the members of the loop are essentially abstaining. And these people here, they're the people who are making the decisions in the system. They're the people who are making the end final calls of what gets to be the law. And once you have this kind of system, you need to be able to change your mind. It's very natural to change your mind. I mean, I do it all the time. I've done it 3 times today. And, you know, the modern democratic systems, they assume that you can't change your mind. Once you put your vote into the ballot box, you cannot change your mind anymore. It's just fixed.
Because, you know, they're not going to let you go fishing after your vote to change it.
And, you know, that's just technically not possible today. But with strong public key cryptography, we can actually do it. It's like the technology for doing this exists. We can say, you know, I'm going to vote on this issue. No, I'm changing my mind. Okay, I'm changing it back. You know, you can do it as often as you like. And by allowing people to do this, you get a lot of free features. The first one is that you can no longer force opinions on people. As I say, I cannot come up to Martin with a gun and say, you're going to vote for this. Because, you know, as soon as I leave, you know, he'll change his mind. The second thing is that changes in trust leads to changes in structure. If I suddenly stop trusting the person that I'm proxying to, the entire structure changes, and suddenly the format of how the law came into effect changes with it. The third thing, which I think is more important, and it's kind of the meta theme of this, it's democracy evolves over time. We've got ourselves locked into this idea where democracy is just something that's really fixed, really well-defined, and, you know, if it's broken, then so what? But, you know, by allowing democracy to evolve, we gain a lot of leeway. And this has already been made. Thing is, I was throwing this idea around with a couple of friends back in October when the Icelandic economy went boom, and turned out that two separate groups went off into separate directions and wrote code, and now we've got this website, direct.democracy.is, that is implementing all of the features of this democratic system that I've already mentioned. It's currently taking like a live feed off the actual Parliament website, dumping into categories, trying to line everything up. We've even got video feeds going, and it's really, really cool. And people can actually participate. It's all in Icelandic, but, you know, whatever. But there are remaining questions in this. Like, okay, if we're taking just from the parliament, who gets to make motions? Is it just the parliamentarians, as it is in most countries? Well, why not everybody? What happens if we let everybody raise a motion? The legal code becomes like a wiki, where you get all the features of a wiki, where the official version is just decided by the votes. And it becomes pre-market motions, and everybody loves pre-markets, right? You know, everybody can participate in making a motion and just throwing it out there and seeing what happens. And then there's a popularity roundup. You get like a Reddit-style thing where the really, really cool motions bubble up to the top and the bad ones just lie down there somewhere. And, you know, how long do motions stay open? Why need we put arbitrary limits? We can change our votes whenever. So, like, how about when motions have enough support, they become the law, if there's more support waves, you know, then they just stop the end of the law. And you can put all sorts of dampening rules that make sure that laws don't fluctuate in and out, but I don't really think they're necessary because, you know, if you've got 63 people that are voting, then sure, one person might change his mind every other day. But if you've got, like, a few million, chances of strong polarization are very, very low and might actually hint at some bigger problem, like I would love to see this kind of law go through in Israel, Palestine, Israel, Palestine. So who can vote? Why need we say to be 18? Because I've never met anybody who's 18 and politically thinking who wasn't politically thinking at 17, right? Any arbitrary limitation is going to damage the entire interaction of the system. So, you know, we can discuss at length whether children have the right to have opinions. I think they do, but, you know, most people might disagree with me. But the important thing is, when people die, why should they have a vote? Why should dead people be able to say anything like this? The oldest law in effect in Iceland right now is from the year 1275, right? No living Icelander, I hope, has agreed to this law. I mean, you know, I did a recent poll. I was giving a talk last weekend, and, you know, asked people there, are you, you know, in support of this law if it were a motion today? And nobody raised their hand. Maybe they were just shy, but, you know. But the fact is that most people don't know what the law says, and it's actually just two articles talking about the rights of churches to own land. So, you know, why should churches own land? Okay, never mind. What we're gaining from all this is a more responsive society. And, you know, it's, you know, the thing that's been going on for century after century after century is that the plutocrats and bureaucrats kind of, you know, they need us to not understand what the law is saying. They need us to you know, not know that there is a, you know, they need to control the flow of information. And we as free software, free hardware, free anything enthusiasts, free culture enthusiasts, say, no, that's not going to work anymore, sorry, you know. That day is over. People need to be informed about what the laws are, and, you know, if they are, they might actually abide by them. You know? There's a big question that always comes up, whether or not this kind of system will lead to a minimalist or a maximalist kind of legal framework. I kind of tend towards thinking that it will be minimalist, because, you know, there's going to be that few things that everybody can agree on, but those things are actually really, really good. But that kind of thing just isn't enough. Oh yeah, then there's the fourth one, the emotions. Anybody who's worked on free software with people who are very easy at disagreeing, you know? Projects fork. Why can't countries fork? I mean, it might sound crazy, but if people have diverging attitudes towards certain issues, why don't they just break up? Settle, you know, settle their differences, go somewhere else.
And South Ossetia, I
mean. Yeah, South Ossetia is a great example. and there are many, many good examples. So... It's a problem that can't be resolved democratically, and obviously not by military means. So, you know, or you know, it just gets, you know, dumbed down every now and then. So, allow people to make up their own minds.
There are those people that they make up their minds. They want to go in a different direction. They want one wants to stay, and the other one wants to go.
Yeah. And why don't
there's no solution? There's no solution.
Sure.
For example, like the rich don't want to carry.
Yeah. Okay, a better example.
The question is to Germany and the system as well, because the United States doesn't support it, doesn't support Georgia, and then Russia supports it, but then the United States is not part of the system problem as well.
A better example would be Flanders and Wallonia in Belgium.
Yeah, but this example is fit
okay.
To your purpose.
As an example of problems that exist with families that want to live and they can't live because the system, the way it is now, it won't let them go.
The borders are too strictly defined.
Serbia, Transnistria, there's a lot of
countries. It's not the country because there are Georgians in South Ossetia and South Ossetians in South Ossetia.
What is same
wanted
in
to
Kosovo,
stay,
but
and the other one wanted to go.
It was the same in Kosovo, but it did happen in Greenland, didn't it?
It's not just, it's quite clear that
yes,
it's geopolitics 101. You know, it's people will not agree on this. If you were voting now, you'd probably vote differently, you know, opposing on this issue. The point is that once you allow people.
Sorry, but I have to interrupt very shortly. How many people would like to go to dinner with us this evening? Just hands up.
Okay, shall we democratize money next?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I love this discussion, but I love these slides too, so I kind of just... okay, so, you know, once we've democratized democracy, big challenge, you know, nobody's going to agree with me on this. What happens if we democratize money? Now, what do we mean when we say democratize money? Well, we need to understand what money is. I mean, you know, everybody's seen that Zeitgeist movie and but, you know, the fact is that money is very centralized today. There's the way money is defined is a very centralized thing. And we have a very cool means of decentralizing it. It's called PGP. You might have heard of it. But money has a few features, and this is from The Future of Money by Bernard Leiter. So the first feature is it's geographically defined. Separate countries have separate currencies. This is partially used as a method of creating nationalism, withholding the group unity, and also trade as a like very simplified form of trade restriction, just to keep goods from traveling over borders without the government getting a chance to put its finger in. And second is that money is created from nothing. This used to be not the case when we had a gold standard and all that stuff, but today money is literally made out of nothing. And I actually think that this is a good thing because gold is inherently scarce. Like there's only so many gold atoms on the planet, right? And besides, if you bind the value of money to a certain commodity, be it gold or rice or, you know, whatever, concrete, we are always going to have people trying to control that substance. So, like the De Beers consolidated mines that have the diamond industry completely enthralled. So they control the price of diamond. Money were a bunch of diamonds, then you know they would control money as well. But money is created through loans. People take bank loans, but essentially, when banks are loaning other banks, and especially central banks are loaning money to the other banks, that is when money is created. That's like the moment of ignition. And that there is the key point, coupled with this one here, the fact that interest is paid on any debt. So when I get a loan, I actually have to pay more money back, which means that, well, can we do the math on this? Like, if there's only £10 existent in the entire system and I borrow it from somebody and they insist that I pay £10.50 back, how am I going to do that? There's no more money in the system, so we always need to create more and more money to solve it. And this is actually what we call a non-zero-sum game, as in you cannot at any point in time say, okay, let's just sum up all the credit and the debit and, you know, get a zero, because, you know, we'll always get a huge negative number, and that negative number increases all the time. Negative if you do it one way, positive if you do it the other, never mind. The point is that having a zero-sum game would be better. So how about we change it? How about if Alice wants to buy something from Bob, Alice takes a piece of paper and writes £10 on it, you know, that's the amount, and then she digitally signs it, and then she encrypts that thing and sends it to Bob. And then Bob wants to buy something from Charles and, you know, does exactly the same thing, digitally signs essentially a agreement saying that
he owes Charles 12 pounds, and then, you know, Charles might owe Alice 9 pounds, and then we resolve the system by everybody just unencrypting the financial statements, essentially, and the entire thing gets zeroed out to the maximum extent possible. Now, of course, this is a very, very simple example. If you were to take the entire network, say the entire network of voters that we had earlier, and just run it through the entire thing, it's analog N problem through your entire algorithms, then you can actually resolve the entire monetary system at the given line.
How about if someone gets for a service, for example, I get for a job, for you serve me something, and I say 10 euros for it. I charge, say, okay, this thing you serve to me, is, for me, it's not, it's, I
need to pay for 10 euros,
or 8 euros.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This thing,
well,
the system.
The thing is, this...
Different views of work.
Yeah, definitely. This thing doesn't aim at equality, really. This is just a measure of how to trade goods, because people today think that we need a monetary system in order to do things. You know, I kind of don't agree, but since everybody believes it, then you know, let's give them one that kind of works. At least one that works better than the current one.
Is there something
like there exists a couple of projects. The best one, to my mind, is Defunct. Yeah, like, it's not working anymore. The guy who was writing it kind of just said, I've got other projects. But I can dig up the name of it later, I kind of can't remember. You can do all of this just using PGP signatures and a bit of code in between. And the encryption part, I only stick that in there because, did you notice the fact that if you encrypt every single financial transaction, then there is no way that any government can tax it to you. Right? And taxation is the foundation of government. If there is no taxes, then there is no government. But okay, so that's basically how this works. And okay, so that's kind of like two of the 9 ideas. That's the monetary system, that's a democratic system. We still need to deal with a bunch of stuff. One of the great things is, like, the monetary system is different from the economy. The economy, well, especially the materials economy, which is kind of what the entire talk is supposed to be about. The materials economy question, or like how things flow between each other. There was somebody who mentioned it during the first session, the work of Stafford Beer. Who's familiar with him? Yeah, it was you, yeah. Stafford Beer was, I think he was from Manchester, in fact. He was a cyberneticist back in the 70s, and very long after that. And in 1971, he was hired by Salvador Allende, the president of Chile, to go to Chile and build what would essentially be called the internet today. It was a long link of teletype machines connected through the phone lines that were supposed to take statistical information from the companies, from the mines, from everywhere where things were being produced, push it back and forth. Actually, it was very hierarchical the way they organized it. There was this big data center in Santiago that was supposed to deal with all the statistical output. But this system called CyberSyn.
Can you write down the name?
Oh, yeah, sure. CyberSyn. There's actually this really, really great talk he gave in 1972 called... it had a name, I'm sure. It was a really good talk in 1972 when the project was alive and well and really doing some awesome stuff. And then in 1973, on the 11th of September, actually, oddly enough, the CIA sponsored Augusto Pinochet to assassinate Allende and take over the country of Chile, with the effect, which might not have been obvious at the time to the people who weren't paying attention,
that Cybersyn was killed. And Cybersyn was essentially the internet.
It was not the internet as we know it today, but it was a market economy. It was like the entire data stream of the economy into cyberspace.
And, you know, the reason that the kind of reason that's normally speculated why CIA sponsored this is that they wanted to keep the world price of copper down, because Chile produced most of the copper in the world, and you know, any sort of high-level, high-tech information system that would, you know, alert workers on how royally they're being screwed would definitely change the world price of copper. So you could say that the CIA killed the internet in order to save the internet. I don't know. So like that there is essentially just a plug-in solution to the economic problem, because we have the internet. All we need to do is find some way of regulating or organizing all the information and put it out there. And when you take that coupled with a peer-to-peer distributed mutualist monetary system, and you know, stick it in with a democracy where people actually have you know, something to say, then we get a lot of things. So I'm going to let you in on a little secret. Most of this work is actually being done, to some extent. Those are my nine little things. Each of them exists in a kind of separate vacuum at the moment, but you know, I've been trying to push so that they all work together in some way. And at the core of it is the identity infrastructure, which for people in like first world, we kind of don't recognize the importance of that kind of infrastructure. It kind of just like we have good databases that take care of us. We don't need a better system. But by completely using the Ubuntu philosophy, saying that I am who I am because of who you all are, then I can be defined. My existence can be defined not by some centralized database run by the government, but by you guys, by you pledging for me essentially, and I for you similarly. And you know, all of these things they're really cool. So I'm just going to end up by pointing out a few books. I kind of missed a lot of really good ones, but you know, yeah, it'll give you something to think about. And any questions?
I have one. It's really a question. How did you solve the following problem? In heaven, that we talked about already.
Yeah.
That an airport. There are too many people living around the airport. And if you expand the airport, there's a group, a small number of people that is going to be, you know, have to move somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
How does your system solve this? Well, this is a problem. But there's a small number of people who vote against it,
Yeah.
But the large number of people say, yeah, I want the airport. It's the not in my backyard issue.
Yeah, definitely.
How would your system solve it?
Well, my system doesn't solve it.
No.
That's the truth. And it doesn't really have to, because people are supposed to solve it. This
yeah.
entire thing is about people at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And you know, all I'm trying to do is improve the infrastructure so that people can solve things
but
better.
I'm actually afraid that democracy as it is in place now, at least in the Netherlands, I don't really know in other countries, if you would prefer something more of this, that it would...
You're worried about mob rule.
More populist. The large amount of people would decide for this more. If you all decide together,
exactly.
The Jews should be that. Real extreme one. It could be done.
Definitely. Definitely those things worry me, but the point about, you know, the Jews being dead, Hitler was never actually popularly voted. He was a minority.
He had a majority.
He was selected by Reichstag.
A genuine democratic majority.
Oh, well, okay, never mind. You know,
please answer history.
Yeah, no, I have this from fairly good references, but never mind. Yeah.
That's a matter of fact. There is some truth to that. I mean, it might be some place in the internet where it arrives differently.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, okay.
According to my standards of truth, it is important that Hitler was elected by the majority of German people, and there is no discussion about it.
Okay. But you know, the point is.
It's about their scarcity.
Yeah, yeah.
Scarcity of space for example.
Yeah, space is scarce. And, okay, there is the option of the fourth motion. So people who live on land can just say, no, we're not going to participate in this anymore, we're going to leave.
Yeah.
And, you know, then it comes down to questions of human rights. Do we have the right to make new states? Do we have the right to not be invaded if we decide that Schiphol Airport is going to be our new city, you know?
We have to
yeah,
only
yeah.
live on.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's say, I'm trying to resist my own friend to disturb a lot of what you proposed based on some films that I find inconsistent with a reality, because I think it would be a wrong attitude, because you are asking, I find some of the questions you are asking to be right, mm-hmm. like the question about democratizing democracy, which is a cool question,
mm-hmm.
I don't so have to answer it, but what strikes me is you have really a focus on an ideal system.
Yes.
Which means that things like transition issues or intermediate stage when you are poor, like for example, you know, you have everyone can change his words all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a paradise of spin doctors.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Or things like that. This I'm not taken in account. So there is a kind of something which is, I have a respect for complexity, and I feel hurt by the fact that by looking only at projecting the idea, you do not take in account the complexity of a trend.
Definitely. Like the entire media thing, like how do we make sure that it doesn't become a media frenzy and democracy be... It's definitely questions that need to be tackled. I think that, you know, with the further democratization of the other stuff, the production, the media, the, you know, all of these foundations, this thing will become less and less of a threat. Like, you know, while there's still people who are controlling the means of information flow, then, you know, any sort of idea like this is very prone to issues.
Let's say to be more constructive, when people started to ask for universal vote, the opponents say, these are damning deals, and they don't know even how to read them. And there was a conscious decision not to wait, to put in place at the same time some processes for people to become more educated, not to read, and the universal vote, and not to wait till. So I understand that, but you can have strategies like that where you make bets, you don't wait for people to be perfect before you make a system that builds on that. That was because you were not doing that for everything at the same time.
The thing that was hidden here was that there are transitional stages. Kind of hinted at it with the website democracy.is, which kind of works as a kind of transition. Essentially, what's happening now is people are slowly hearing about it, and you know, going and placing their vote, and you know, we're doing all sorts of stuff to fix it into social networking, so it would be a Facebook application and whatnot. And hopefully, at some point, we'll have enough mass behind it that one of two things will happen. Either parliamentarians will start doing exactly what is said on there, in which case they're proving themselves obsolete, or they will consciously decide to ignore it, in which case they're proving themselves to be at contrast with the general populace. Either way, they kind of
shoot themselves. What if they copy it?
What?
What if they copy it or try to copy it and make their own government?
Yeah. Well, they will. They will. You'll probably have to deal with it.
Let me take up a innocent example, the example of the golden age.
Okay.
I mean, your point, I'm sympathetic with the story. Your point, of course, is well taken that arbitrarily putting the golden age in
ideas is not as specific as you would like. Now, on the other hand, if you are 2 or 3 or 4 years, what you are going to do is exactly what your parents told you to do all the time. Now, and there is just no way.
I know loads of 25-year-olds who do that.
And but there is just no way in any detail at which particular time a child would be autonomous enough. So that it could vote. This is an completely impossible problem.
Yeah.
And the way the society dealt with it is to have an arbitrary, I agree with you, an arbitrary limit.
Yeah.
Now, what any relaxation of this arbitrary limit, say to in Reykjavik, they are allowed to do it with 7, whereas in Copenhagen, whatever, they are allowed to do it with 7.5. That's just the same arbitrary.
Definitely. Which one option?
I don't know any other.
We're running out of time, actually. I understand.
Can I say something? You are totally right, but you could consider it as a type of experiment. So the information coming out of such limited arbitrary decisions might be very valuable for the whole global system. We might discover what works and what doesn't work.
Yes?
Yeah. I think that your position today, there's two differentiations I would like to make. One is between abundance and scarcity, and one is about the micro.
Okay.
So for example, whenever something is abundant, then there's absolutely no problem with applying some of the other ideas because you're not hurting anybody else. A good example of this is free software. As long as we're making the free software, we have a self-regulating community, but when we're talking about the servers that are needed, then we have foundations that are practically regulated.
Yeah.
Because it affects the whole community. And so the problem in Georgia with Sarapisha is the fusion of scarcity and abundance, because political power is related to scarce resources, and nobody will. But if you could split up and say, okay, we can have cultural autonomy, and that wouldn't affect the political, then people wouldn't be afraid of that autonomy. So we have to learn to distinguish between the scarcity and abundance and modulate, because it's polarity, so it's kind of difficult. And the other thing is between micro and micro, which, what I think what you're doing is very useful. As community of people who want to be autonomous, we want as much as we can control our destiny, and therefore we hack whatever we can, which is democracy, money, etc. But we apply this in our own community first. And if it works, then we can talk to the macro society and say, well, if you try this out, this might work for you, right?
Yes.
Well, we shouldn't dream that we can. You know, like why we say, you know, let's have this kind of voting system or monetary system. The first part because we don't have the power, and secondly because you don't know all the possible negative consequences. So we need to try it first ourselves.
Yeah.
And a monetary system that works within our community.
Or no monetary system
you can have.
Without
the experience we can talk in terms of policy.
Yeah.
In
terms of scale, there's a few really neat sociological and mathematical principles at work. One is Dunbar's law, or Dunbar's number, from Robin Dunbar, an anthropologist who said that human societies are essentially limited to 150 people, or that's like the tribal community. Once they grow bigger than that, then the interrelationships between any given pair of people is just unmanageable. And by way of Metcalfe's law, you've got 150 people, turns out to be about 11,175 connections between pairs. And come on, who's going to be able to manage that? You know, so there's those two laws. There's Metcalfe's law, there's Dunbar's law. And then you've got the other two, which are essentially the 6 degrees of separation on the one hand, and then that thing on the other. The thing that I was talking with Martin about earlier, which was that in any system, a system is called self-organizing if
redundancy increases over time. And redundancy is defined as 1 minus the entropy divided by the maximum possible entropy in the system. So the more redundant a system becomes, the more slack it has, the more capability it has to deal with new experiments.
I agree with a lot of what you've said. One thing that we're missing in a conversation about it is the whole condition of peak oil. We're actually, we've actually got all the industrial society has been built on the large availability of fossil fuels. We've now, it looks very likely, passed kind of peak oil last year. Peak gas and peak coal probably not far away. Plus, we've got the ecological consequences of very old fossil fuels in terms of climate change. So, I mean, you know, all the infrastructure that's been built up on through the available fossil fuel is,
Definitely very, very much broken. And I'm hoping that the open hardware movement as a whole will be able to take care of that. Like, we have somebody here with open source car. it was here last night. We kind of like we have movements. Oh yeah, the circle. We have movements that are working on these problems, and you know, essentially they're related and yet somewhat tangential. So, you know, I completely agree. Peak oil is a problem. Climate change is messed up.
The whole thing you can also relate to scarcity and maybe renewability, because we all thought that oil was endless with all of us. And so scarcity only exists at the point that it happens.
Yeah.
Usually that happens later than you could see coming, and I think.
Then there's also the artificial controls on these resources. The OECD, no wait, the OPEC countries saying, oh no, we're only going to sell this many barrels this year.
But it's artificial because it's theirs.
They're scarcifying something that everybody else needs. I mean, I'm not saying that the oil in the ground isn't scarce, but they definitely have a lot of regulations and you know, regulatory capability of
situation in the airport situation.
Yeah.
They're sitting low.
Yeah.
And they can do with it what they want.
Yeah.
Sure. It's cars do you want.
Mm-hmm. And we kind of need to have to deal with it. We can, you know, find something that isn't scarce.
I just wanted to mention that we use a category rival risk. I don't know if you're aware of what we've got now more recently, called the positional consumption. This is called the positional goods, as well as public goods. A company called Ben Ellish, what they call social goods to growth in the 1970s, very early 1970s. And that's really very, very important to concern about the material economy, because a lot of these are turned into positional goods. Even a job can be turned into positional goods. Like, you limit the number of jobs for doctors, and that becomes an object of consumption.
Yeah.
And people consume a lot. An awful lot of consumption is driven by the need to get your child into university, but you become a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, and then you prioritize education. It's part of all the engines of inequality.
I've never heard of it. What's the name?
Fred Hirsch.
I'll have to remember that somehow.
He talks when Daniel Day, towards the person in the world society, when he thinks about what we discuss in the with the abundance of information, he mentions the positions.
Okay, yeah.
And that's quite the other
I
don't agree with the book that you in the decision making.
There are ways to deal with position, positionary goods. For example, one of the ideas there is peer-to-peer education, where I've always really hated the education system in that it forces me to come and sit down at lectures day after day after day, and at the end of 3 years, I suddenly magically get an education. I mean, of course, it's not like that, but the way the degrees are structured, you don't get an education until you suddenly got the paper. And you know, I kind of dislike that. So the idea of peer-to-peer education, for me, is partially the idea of people teaching each other, and you know, that way we're kind of ridding ourselves of the positionary things in education by saying, if you want to learn something, find somebody who can teach it to you. But there's so many things to worry about in that thing. So. Yeah. That's hard to do. Okay. So, how are we for time?
I don't know. Okay for time. There are other more questions?
Well, I mean, you can come chat afterwards if you want. I'm personally more comfortable with that kind of format. There's, I kind of sweat when I'm in front of a lot of people. Yeah, somebody's, I think two different recordings are going. Yeah, and the slides, they're all, first of all, Creative Commons, meaning that you can do with them what you wish.
So many slides.
We will put all the slides in
You see the URL at the bottom? The exec.org/talks209. It's not there yet. I had problems getting online, but it will be there, and it's in the Creative Commons open document format. So feel free.
Thank you very much.
There are some locations where you can get something to eat from. Maybe you can just get there and use it out there. Thank you.
That's exactly what he writes. The only real thing is the individual. Yeah. Everything else is human.
Exactly. Yeah.
Your dishes that you're building in the chicken are fantastic.
Yeah, not my idea.
Shall we? All right. This time, really seriously. Let's go with you. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I've never been there myself, actually.
If you go to there,
I think it's somewhere around there. But
it's in the country.
Yeah.
Are you going to Ghana?
No, Ghana.
Ghana, okay.
There's a couple up there, too, so...
Kenya,
Ghana, South Africa.
That is an issue.
Definitely, and just, you know, so much fun being able to do that because it was such a tangible, like, kind of proved the entire concept of the hardware.
Able to actually also do a bowl without us.
Okay, yeah,
so
that,
you have something like that.
We had, it was really, really beautiful, just like 3 or 4 days ago, about the sea metal, because we built up that part of the network, and then we kind of just had to leave. There was an orphanage just about 300 people away from the hospital where we had to. And they went to the Fab Lab and they made themselves a pair of antennas and set up
just have the ability to build the
infrastructure and the environment.
And also, it's nice.
I kind of like the entire idea of, the dirty thing appearing to networking a little is that we use NAT on every single set of things. So, essentially, any pair of antennas is completely segregated in networking terms. And that means